Okay, so I think it's a couple of minutes early maybe, but I'll get started. So this is going to be the last class, as I had mentioned, and today we'll just do a special topic. Okay, this is not something from the book, it's just some material put together for this course. So we'll focus this class's effort on discussing data centers and cloud computing and their relationship to distributed systems. So there are two parts. So I'll talk first about data centers in more general terms, and then we'll talk mostly about cloud computing, which is a special type of data center that's used for special type of internet services. So let's start with this notion of data center. So I thought I'd put a picture here, but maybe not. So what are data centers? Data centers are essentially very large server and storage farms. Okay, so think of large number of racks with lots and lots of servers, very large enterprise storage systems, and they're pretty much used by any entity that wants to provide a large scale computing service today. Okay, so everything from pretty much any enterprise or any company that provides IT services to its users, okay, uses a data center of some sort, and they are especially popular for internet companies. Okay, so if you take Google, Facebook, YouTube, Amazon, all of their services essentially run on data centers. Okay, and there is a spectrum of these data centers. There is some starting from small data centers to really large ones. Okay, data centers used by Amazon, Facebook, and YouTube, they fall into the larger spectrum. Larger side of the spectrum. So for instance, Google data centers tend to have tens or hundreds of thousands of servers. Okay, so if you think of a very large building that houses 100,000 servers, that's the class of data centers we are talking about on one side of the spectrum. They cost upwards of $1 billion to build a single data center, and these companies have many, many such data centers across the globe. Okay. At the other end of the spectrum, we have a small data center. These can be $10 or $100 million each. Okay, so it's still not small by small standards, but those are sort of the small end of the spectrum. They may have anywhere between 1,000 to 10,000 servers. Okay, so if you think of any organization that needs an order of few thousand servers to provide computing support to its employees. This could run all sorts of applications. I mean, it's clear in case of internet companies what they're running. They're running all of the things that you actually see: Gmail, the search engines, and the Facebook applications and whatnot. In enterprises, the use of data centers is for a variety of different applications. Everything from your payroll system to your bookkeeping, accounting systems to computing systems that the enterprise may need to run simulation or computationally intensive jobs. So if you look at financial companies or banks, all of the banking systems, stock trading systems, they will all be housed on data centers. Okay, and traders may run simulations of various trading strategies, okay, which require lot of computational resources. Those would also run on data centers. So the range of applications that you will see in enterprises, okay, is much greater than what you will see in internet companies, because they may have a few or up to a dozen different applications, but they are very large scale, highly replicated. Okay, in enterprises, you may have lots and lots of different applications. You are just using this very large IT infrastructure to house them all. Okay, so as I said, size of a data center can vary anywhere from a few thousand to 100,000 servers. Okay. And then there is also the storage component. So the size of the storage that you will need to run these applications is also quite large. You can have everything from local storage, which is that you are just using the disk that is on the machine, okay, on the server, to centralized enterprise grade storage, which could be in petabytes. So if you have very large databases or data warehouses where you're storing lots and lots of data, typically you would put that on a central store of some sort. Okay, that will usually be on what's called a storage area network. I'll mention that in a few slides. Okay, so So what I'm going to do, so with that background, what I want to do now is to actually talk about the architecture of these data centers and how they are typically used. Okay? So in the traditional, what we call traditional data centers, you essentially have these racks of servers. Okay? So you have, let's say, many of racks of these servers. These are rack mount servers. So you'll have lots of racks of these. And they will be running some application. The mapping of which applications to run on which servers is determined by some IT administrator. Okay, depending on the needs of the application, you may say, okay, put these applications on these racks. Okay, racks 1, 2, 3 or 1. You can assign some racks and some servers on those racks. So each of these racks can have, let's say, 40 servers or 60 servers, depending on how the servers are designed. So the mapping is determined by IT administrator. Application can be distributed or centralized or replicated. It really depends on the app. Okay? You could have database servers like Oracle, which could be replicated or clustered on a very large number of servers. Okay? And you may have very small applications that run on only one server. Okay? So you have this entire range, and some human has to figure out okay, how to map these applications on the server. So if you think about a large data center with, let's say, it has 10,000 servers, okay, you may have same order of magnitude of application with several thousand applications running on these 10,000 servers. So then somebody has to keep track of all of the applications running in your data center. What storage are they using? Which machines are they running on? Keep track of machines are getting overloaded, move them to larger machines. So all of this has to be done by humans. Okay. So what they should tell you is that managing this large-scale IT infrastructure is not an easy job. Okay. You may have a group of people who are administering it, but nevertheless, the infrastructure itself is very, very large, okay, on the order of several thousands of servers, okay, and several thousands of applications. Each application is different. Okay. Trying to make sure all of the applications are running fine and they have the sufficient storage, sufficient capacity, storage, computational capacity, bandwidth, is somebody's day-to-day job. Okay, so if something fails, they have to figure out what happened, fix it, and so on. Okay, so this is not an easy thing to deal with. Okay, and the other problem with this infrastructure is things are constantly changing. Okay, it's not like the infrastructure or the software or the workload is static. Everything is in constant state of flux. Okay. Machines will constantly fail, machines will be upgraded every few months, applications will be also modified, okay, you will introduce new functionality, you will modify it, new versions of the applications will get deployed, and the workload itself will change, okay, some applications may become popular within an enterprise and others may no longer be needed. So you have to keep changing the mapping of applications to infrastructure and mapping of, the infrastructure itself over time. Okay, so this is not a static infrastructure. If it was static, the workload was static, things would be much easier. But everything is changing and you have to keep the system operational in the midst of change, okay, which further complicates the management of these large-scale data centers. Okay. Now, the storage is something I will not talk about a whole lot, but let me just mention how typically it is used. So as I said, you have this rack of compute servers. Each of these may have a local disk. Okay. Traditionally, you don't put any important data on the local disk on these servers. You just keep the OS image and local configuration files. Okay. The actual and maybe application code may reside on this disk, but the data itself is kept on some centralized storage. So typically, you have these what are called enterprise storage systems. These are essentially disk farms. There are lots and so they are racks of disks that are connected over a network to these computational devices. Okay. This network could be your traditional local area network or it could be a special network. Okay. If it's a special network, it's typically, well, not necessary, but this network is typically referred to as a storage area network or a SAN. Okay, you heard of a LAN, which is local area network. So this is a network where the computational nodes talk to disks, okay, because the disks are not attached directly to nodes. They are actually kept on separately, okay, on a centralized set of racks. And their connection is through a special network called a storage area network. Okay, there are different instantiations of this. Okay, the traditional instantiation was what is called fiber channel. Okay, there is a special kind of network, just as your Ethernet, fiber channel is a protocol that you use to implement a storage area network. The network behaves where more or less similar to a local area network, except that the only traffic on this network is from compute nodes to disk. It is all I/O traffic. You don't have any other traffic on this node. Okay. More modern versions of this basically have merged the notion of a storage area network and a local area network. So these machines can talk to disk over traditional Ethernet. Okay. So in this case, your protocol such as iSCSI. Okay. This is IP over SCSI. Okay. So you know what a SCSI disk is. It's a IO protocol. So what happens here is these are SCSI disks. These machines interact with this SCSI disk over traditional TCP/IP. So you encapsulate IP commands into TCP/IP packets or IP packets and send them to disks. Disk interpret this packet, do the whatever IO request has come in and send back request. Okay, so communication is now not over a SCSI bus, it's actually over an IP network or a LAN. Okay, and this uses more protocols like iSCSI to do this. Okay. So this is how your typical enterprise storage system will interact with compute store. Okay, then there is the management of the disks itself, which is another big issue. You have to decide which disks are being allocated to which applications. These are typically RAID arrays. So you heard of RAID in this in the context of this course. So these are typically arrays where you have redundancy built in, but nevertheless you have to figure out how much storage space to allocate to which application. Make sure that if two applications, or not two, but some applications are sharing certain disks, that you don't cause overloads or hotspots in your system. You want load to be balanced across disks. All of this is the task of the storage administrator. Okay? Another complicated problem. When you have 1,000 applications, you have to figure out how much storage to give to whom, which of them will be co-located on which disks, so you don't run out of storage space, you don't cause hotspots or overloads on your disks. Okay, so this is basically a quick snapshot of what traditional data center architecture looks like. Okay, machines are allocated to applications, and applications may share machines, may get the dedicated machines. They're connected to storage devices which are centralized, okay? And data is accessed from this centralized store using specialized protocols, okay, or a storage area network of some sort. Any questions on this? This clear? Yes? No? Okay. So that's the traditional architecture. So now what you are seeing in more recent years is the use of virtualization in data centers to make some of these problems simpler to deal with. Okay, so as you can imagine, managing this large infrastructure is not easy, and virtualization has been proposed as one technique which will allow you, which will simplify some but not necessarily all of the management tasks. So what happens in the virtualized architectures is you still have your cluster of machines. Okay. But each of them runs a hypervisor. Okay. What we have referred to in this course as a type 1 hypervisor. Okay. And then administrators can create virtual machines, one or more, per server, and applications actually run inside virtual machines. Okay, so now in this architecture, the apps don't run on physical servers, they actually run on virtual servers, and virtual servers are mapped onto some set of physical servers. Okay, so there is one level of indirection. Applications are running inside virtual servers. And so on. Okay. So now question is, what is this going to, how is, does this simplify anything? Okay, we talked about all these problems of your thousands of machines, thousands of applications. Somehow you have to ensure that sufficient capacity is allocated and whatnot. Okay, so how is virtualization going to help us handle some of these problems?
Yes. Some virtual machine can keep track of how much data it's using, how much storage, and it can actually remap things on the fly.
Yes. So virtual machines, so as was just mentioned, what you can track what the virtual machines are using and remap things on the fly. You know, the this is an important benefit of virtualization. I don't know if I have mentioned this when we talked about virtualizations fairly early on in this course, but typically the picture you have is one of a hypervisor and a virtual machine that is running on top of this hypervisor. There's a guest OS here and there's an application running here. Okay. Now, because the application is running on a guest OS and this is running on this virtual machine, the hypervisor can flexibly decide how much resources to allocate to this virtual machine. For instance, if you decide that this application needs more RAM, on the fly you can actually assign. The hypervisor can give it more memory. Okay? If you decide that this application needs more CPU and you may have multiple cores here, okay, you can assign multiple more cores to this guest OS, okay, more CPU, and this can be done on the fly without having to shut down the application. You just basically start getting more more CPU time. Okay, so the application and the OS as a whole start running faster. So a lot of this reconfiguration or reallocation of reassignment of resources can be done on the fly without having to take down the application and whatnot. Okay? It is also possible, if you go back to the lecture on virtualization, I mentioned that you can use migration using virtualization. Okay? So you can, if this machine is, let's say it's a dual core machine, two cores, if this machine is insufficient to has insufficient capacity to handle this application's need, you can actually migrate the virtual machine to a bigger server, let's say a four core quad core server. Okay. And this can be done actually without even shutting down the OS. Okay, the migration can be done live while the application is running. The memory state of this virtual machine is moved here. Okay. Disk state is anyway on central storage, so there is nothing to move. So this machine can access those disks like this other machine. So all you have to do is move the memory state and just start running the application. Okay. Now, if you had as a old architecture where you are actually running on a physical server, this is not trivial. Okay. You have a disk that has an OS image that may have an application. You might actually have to copy the disk contents over and whatnot. Okay. Here, you're just moving the memory snapshot and everything is fine. Okay, so this actually simplifies, because there is flexibility in mapping from virtual to physical resources. Okay, allocation of resources to individual applications is simplified. Mapping of applications to servers is also simplified. Okay, it is easier to change that mapping. It can be changed even in your traditional architecture, but the effort involved in doing so is much greater. Okay. And virtualization has simplified some of those tasks for you. Okay. And because of this, these benefits, more modern data center architectures are virtualized. Okay. Typically, your machines will actually run a hypervisor and everything runs inside virtual machines rather than running them on physical servers. Okay. This is not universally true, but it is increasingly true. Yeah, because as IT administrators are realizing those benefits, they are deploying virtualization in their data centers. Okay, so I already mentioned that you can change these allocations and you can migrate it. The other thing you can also do is applications can be started from pre-configured virtual machine images. Okay, so these are often referred to as appliances. An appliance is simply a virtual machine with an OS and an application already installed and configured for you. So you just download this virtual machine image and you just start it. Okay? There is no CD to install or anything like that. You just get the image and start. It's already pre-configured for you. This also simplifies your task. So you don't have to get individual applications and install them and configure them. Somebody has already constructed this package for you, which includes the OS, the application and its configuration. So this will also simplify. So if you want to deploy an application on 200 machines, for instance, okay, if you just had these images, you could just quickly deploy them. Otherwise, you have to deploy the OS on each machine and then install the application on each machine and configure each machine, which takes a lot of time and effort. Okay, so some of these installation and configuration tasks can also be simplified in a virtualized environment. Okay. So now that's the configuration time issue. But as I mentioned, most of these data centers see constant change. Okay. So one important reason for this change is the workload may itself change. Okay. The other things I mentioned is the machines may come and go. You may upgrade the machines, or you may have new versions of the applications. You have to upgrade the software itself. Okay, so that may happen at a slightly slower time scale, but what you do see is the workload can change fairly quickly, okay, depending on the application. Okay, this is especially true for internet applications. So if you have any application that's internet facing, a web-based application, it is likely to see dynamic workloads. Okay, more importantly, you don't have any control over the workload. Okay, you put up a website, let's say you have a blog. You don't really control who can view it and how many users are going to visit. If you write on something that is very popular and somebody discovers this, or you get indexed in a search engine and your results start appearing, you will see a lot of traffic coming to your website. Okay? So it's not very easy to control, or not necessarily control, but even predict the workload that many applications are going to see, okay, ahead of time. So then that raises the question of how much capacity would you actually allocate to this application. So suppose that you are deploying this new application, okay, in your data center. Okay, you don't know exactly what kind of workload to see. Is it going to be wildly popular and you will have lots and lots of concurrent users, or it's not at all, nobody really wants to use this application, so not very many users come and access it. Okay, you don't know which of the two is going to be true. Okay, so then how much capacity do you allocate? You allocate lots of servers and then you wasted a lot of capacity because the expected users haven't arrived. Or if you start saying, let me start small and just put it on one or two servers, and then a huge traffic surge arrives and then your server just buckles under the load, that's also a bad thing. Okay? So typically incorrect workload estimate, okay, cause you to over or under provision capacity. Capacity is just the number of servers you have allocated to the application. Okay, so you are allocating capacity in units of servers in this case. So you don't know whether to allocate, what to allocate. So you can take a guess. If you overshot the guess, you gave it too many servers and servers are lying idle and wasted. If you did and you allocated too little, then your users are getting turned away because your application got overloaded. Okay. So this is a problem for many internet applications. Okay. So, and then on top of all of this, you have this occasional workload surges. Okay. These are referred to as flash crowds. Okay. So this often happens in news sites. Okay. Some story breaks and then everybody wants to go and read this newspaper site and it gets overloaded and it goes down. Okay. So typically on election days or any big story breaks, this happens to many websites. Okay. This is called a flash crowd. Okay, it can also happen if you are an e-commerce retailer. Let's say you have this Thanksgiving sale. Okay, this was very common a few years back. You have this Thanksgiving sale. Everybody wants to go and see what you are offering online. So the workload that you see on that particular day is maybe an order of magnitude higher than your typical normal workload. Okay. Now if your capacity isn't provisioned accordingly, if you don't have 10 times the number of servers provision for that, at least that day that you have on a normal day, your system is going to go down. Okay, this has happened to many sites, like Best Buy went down and even Amazon had problems a few years back. Okay, and this is often because you don't know what kind of traffic you are going to see because of these special events that are occurring. You could be wildly off the mark, and if you over-provisioned capacity, at least that's good, you didn't turn your customers away. If you under-provisioned, that's usually bad news. Okay. You lost revenue because customers would have made a sale, cannot even get to the site, and worse, you have bad publicity. Okay. There's every news article saying this important site has gone down because it couldn't handle the workload. Okay. So it's an important problem. Now you don't exactly know how to deal with it. This is not as much of a problem in traditional application. If you have like a database server for a university, it's not going to see wildly varying demand. Okay. The demand is fairly static, predictable. Okay. This may not be true for every such application. If you take Spire, for instance, which is an application, it will have varying demand. Okay, during registration periods, you will see a lot more demand than on other periods. Okay? And if you don't provision capacity accordingly, your system will go down. This actually happened a few years back when Spire was initially first rolled out. They didn't really know what workload they were going to see. So during registration period, it crashed. Students couldn't register. So then they had to say on this date only students with last name A can register because we can't deal with the rest, and then on this day B. So they actually had to do all this on the fly. Okay. Subsequently, I think they have figured out how to handle the capacity, but it's just an indication of the problem that you can face. Okay. So now what do you do about this? I mean, if you are actually running an internet application, you have this game of trying to always keep ahead of the workload somehow. Now, typically the kind of techniques that are being deployed to do this, okay, is what is called dynamic provisioning. Okay. So here what you are doing is you don't try to guess ahead of time, okay, what is the workload going to be over the next 3 months and I'll find enough servers to do this. You do this actually in real time. You track what your workload looks like, what the workload patterns look like, and if the workload starts trending upwards, you start adding capacity to your application, so you are trying to at least stay somewhat ahead of where the workload is headed. Okay? So typically these systems have to perform three steps. Okay? There's a monitor step, there's a predict or an estimate step, and a provision step. In the monitor step, you are actually tracking the workload that is coming into your application. Okay? And you are analyzing the workload for trends. Is it going up? What rate is it going up? So you would actually do this kind of analysis. Yeah. And based on that, you make an estimate. Okay, if the workload has started rising 20% an hour for some reason because it's Thanksgiving Day sale and people have started accessing your website, you keep track of that and you predict. Okay, typically, you want to stay ahead of the workload. So you project from that, saying what is going to happen based on this trend over the next several hours. And you estimate what the peak workload you are going to see would look like based on these trends. Okay. And then you say, if this is the peak workload, do I have enough capacity right now in my for my application? If I don't, then I start adding more servers, saying, okay, let's, and the servers, the application is assumed to be replicated, obviously. Okay, so you have a number of these replicas. So you add more replicas, you add more servers to this system. Okay, that's the provision step. And this keeps a loop that continues. Okay, and when the workload ebbs, you have to do the reverse. Okay, you may have 6 times the capacity of the workload. There is no reason to keep those servers idle. You just shut the applications down on those, or the replicas down on those machines, and return those servers, okay, back to the data center pool. So that's what is typically done to deal with these workload changes. So here you can actually track the workload, and depending on what's happening, you will have enough capacity. And there are two types of these dynamic provisioning techniques. One is called predictive and the other one is called reactive. Okay. Predictive tries to predict workload from further into the future and tries to provision for it ahead of time. Okay, you say, okay, what is the workload going to be tomorrow, next month? Okay, if you are in November and then you say, what should I do for December? I'm an e-commerce retailer. You know that December sales are going to be higher. Okay. You use historical trends or you use trends, current trends, to predict an estimate, and you try to do this ahead of time. Okay. That's called predictive provisioning, meaning you try to bring capacity online before the workload hits the application. Okay. Reactive provisioning actually reacts whenever the capacity falls short of demand. So you look at what's happening now. Okay. If the workload that you are seeing now is lower than the capacity of provision, you don't try to predict what's going to happen in the future. You just look at now, is there enough capacity? If the answer is no, then add more capacity. Okay. So there are these two approaches. Okay. Now clearly, if you think about it, you would prefer to be in the predictive provisioning regime rather than the reactive provisioning. Okay. Because this is already trying to project into the future and trying to bring capacity before the workload increase arrives, and thereby all your customers or users are happy. Okay. In reactive provisioning, okay, if the current workload has fallen short of the capacity, then some requests are actually getting dropped or turned away. Okay. And then once you react to it and add capacity, your users are going to be happy again. Okay. Yes, you have a question.
You could react with the threshold saying, like, if my server is 70% active,
I'm
going to add another server.
Yeah. So typically, you will never wait for it to be 100%. You will always have this high watermark or a threshold at which point you will start adding. Okay. Okay. Nevertheless, my question was going to be, why would you ever do reactive provisioning if you could do predictive provisioning? Is there any reason to do this when you could, if you could predict and do provision capacity ahead of time? Yes.
We get wastage of resources, like we allocate many resources and then we see that they are not utilized. So reactive, we can actually accurately.
Yeah. Okay, so prevent wastage. So you could have predicted, but maybe you predicted far too ahead of time and you allocated more capacity than you need. Okay, so you're saying reactive, you know exactly what the workload is now. That's a fact. Okay, here you're predicting into the future. That's an estimate. Okay, it's not guaranteed that that's actually what is going to happen. Okay, what you're seeing now is what is actually happening. Okay, so this is always going to be accurate. That is not. Okay. At the same time, this is going to be problematic in the near term if your workload capacity is temporarily exceeded by the workload. Okay. Now, the reason you actually cannot just do predictive provisioning is there are some events you cannot predict. Like I talked about flash floods or new story breaks. You don't know when the next big story is going to break and what kind of traffic that is going to bring to your website. It could be a small story saying storm in Amherst or something like that, or it could be something pretty important that lots of users are going to go. So depending on what the story is and when it breaks, you will actually see different workload surges. This you cannot predict ahead of time. Okay? So in some, even if you may be predicting long-term growth, okay, steady growth in your application, or for that matter some near term growth, workload surges you will never be able to predict accurately ahead of time. That you really have to react to. Okay? So that's the reason you actually need this reactive provisioning. Okay? Also your predictions could be wrong. Okay, you may have predicted but you may have underestimated. Your prediction may not be accurate. So you need reactive provisioning to correct for those estimates so you can actually add more capacity than what the prediction told you to do. Okay, so in some sense, just having one or the other is not necessarily enough. Okay? Now again, that's dynamic provisioning. Now this could be done even in your traditional data center. Okay, you don't need virtualization to do this. But in traditional data centers, your time lag in adding capacity is much larger. Okay, because what you have to do is, if you have to bring up additional replicas, you have to see whether there are some servers that are idling or free. Okay? If so, then you take those servers, assign them to this application. You might have to first install the OS, install the application, configure it, bring it up, okay, start it up, and then the application is ready to service request. This can take an order of few minutes, tens of minutes. Okay, you may have automated the install of OS and whatnot, but it's nevertheless going to take few tens of minutes. Okay, the workload has already surged. For those few tens of minutes, your users are going to see bad performance. Okay, but nevertheless, you can do this even in traditional architecture. Okay, now if you don't have a free server, then you have to go and look for an underutilized server and reclaim it, saying I'm temporarily going to take this server from this other application that's not using that machine and assign it to this application that needs additional capacity. That will add further to the time lag, okay, because you have to shut down that application and then reinstall or scrub the data off and then reinstall the OS and whatnot. Okay? So again, it takes tens of minutes to add capacity. It's not instantaneous. In a virtualized data center, you can speed up this process. Okay? It's still not instantaneous, but you will speed this up in several ways. Okay. For instance, if you are going to reclaim an underused server, all you have to do is take that virtual machine and just move it somewhere. Okay. You can migrate it off, and while it is being migrated, you can actually start another virtual machine because multiple VMs can run on a server. Okay. They are independent virtual machines. So you could have started your application that needs capacity while this underutilized one is being moved off. So you could do things like that, and all the time lag is just the time it takes you to copy this virtual machine image onto that machine and boot up the OS. Okay, because the application is actually pre-configured in this virtual machine image for you. So it is much faster to do this in the virtualized case, and typically if you employ dynamic provisioning, it is more often the case that you will use a virtualized architecture. You can still do this here, but it is much slower. Okay. Now contrast this to some administrator has to deal with this problem. Okay, so application workload surges, application request gets dropped, somebody may be monitoring applications, some IT administrator will say, oh, something bad is happening to this application. So then they say, what do? Let's add capacity. So then you have to go around manually hunt for some machines that are idle. So okay, let's give this machine to this application. You install the OS. Okay, that will take hours. Okay, so typically reaction times have to go down. If you want to really deal with the internet applications and your customers are actually paying for your services, a store or some such thing, you want to react in seconds or minutes, not in hours. Okay, whenever you have problems with your system. Any questions on this? Okay. So that is resource management in data centers. So that's one problem that you have to deal with. Another big problem in data centers is managing the energy usage of these data centers. Okay. Now, you may have read about this. So it turns out that energy usage has become a major component of the operational cost of data centers. Okay, because you have these tens or hundreds of thousands of servers. Okay, they take a lot of electricity to keep powered up. Okay, and machines generate heat. So all of these data centers have to be cooled. Okay, so there are two big energy costs. The cost of powering the servers and the cost of cooling these servers. Okay, and it turns out that this is actually a huge cost for larger data centers. Okay, a large data center is not unusual to have energy bills running in millions of dollars a month. Okay, so every month you get bills that are in order of several million dollars. For small data center, it could be in order of hundreds or thousands of dollars of electricity and cooling costs, air conditioning costs. So it is a significant cost of to operate your data center, to power these machines. Okay. So there is a lot of emphasis on how do you go about reducing the energy cost of these data. How do you use your resources more judiciously so that you get a lower electric bill or lower air conditioning cost. Okay. Now the other problem is these data centers, as a result of their large energy usage, also have a very large carbon footprint. I mean, they generate a lot of carbon dioxide. So there is a lot of emphasis on designing what are called green data centers, which are lower, more efficient in their energy use and have a lower carbon footprint. Okay, so it's important for large companies that actually use a lot of servers, okay, to show that they are actually responsible corporate citizens. They have to look at this issue of what is their carbon footprint and how do you reduce it. Okay, so because of both of these issues, okay, issue being you have to pay lots of money to just keep your machines up and running, and you have to ensure that your carbon footprint is lower, there's a lot of emphasis on reducing the energy usage of this machine. Okay. So then the question is, what can you do? Okay. The big issue is why there is this large energy usage is typically a workload demands tend to vary over time. So there is a tendency to over-engineer the system or over-provision. Okay. If you say, I expect workload of X, then typical solution is, let's give X capacity plus some headroom. Okay? Now in the average case, the average workload may be much lower than the peak workload. Okay? So typically what happens is the workload keeps changing. So if you take typical web workloads, you have this thing called time of day effects, where in the daytime or around noon the workload peaks, and in the middle of the night the workload is the lowest. So you have these daily effects that you see. Okay, so workload on these applications keep changing. Okay. So typically what you do is you look at the peak and you provision for the peak, but in the average you may be somewhere here. Okay. So in the average case, the utilization of these machines is much lower. So typical statistics say that average utilization of a server in a data center is around 10%, meaning the server is actually loaded at 10% of its capacity or is actually being used only 10% of the time, and other times it's idling. Okay. But it's up and running, which means it's consuming electricity and it needs to be cooled. Okay. Then the question is, what do you do? Okay. Now, the most useful thing to do is to ensure that your systems that you are building are what are called energy proportional. Okay. So if you have what is called an energy proportional system, then the energy use of that system or that machine is proportional to the load. Okay, if you have an energy proportional system, then the profile of a system looks like this. So it's a linear curve. Okay. This is load. Load can go from 0 to 100%. This is the max energy usage and that's the min. So the energy usage also goes from 0 to max as the load goes from 0 to 100%. Okay. If you had a system like this, then you wouldn't have to do anything because if your machines are underutilized, they're also, I mean, if you have 10% of the load, then it's only consuming 10% of the energy. Okay, so that's okay. But it so happens that no real server looks like this. Okay, its profile is something like this. Okay, which means even at 0% load, the energy usage is somewhere around 60% of the max. Okay. This is because even if you are not using the machine at all, its disk is spinning. Okay, so it is going to consume power no matter what. Okay, its fans may be running to cool the machine down. Okay. CPU may be idling, but it's still on. Okay. Your system bus will consume some energy. The power supply is on. Okay. So all of these components are on and they are wasting energy. Okay. So even at 0% load, your machine is taking up 60% of its capacity. And as the load goes up, the fan speed will increase, the disk will do more I/O, and the CPU will do more computation. So the energy usage will go up with load. But it's not a curve that goes to zero. It basically starts from some non-zero value and goes to its max. Okay? So as a result, energy, since machines are not energy proportional, that just says that even if all of your machines were idling, okay, your energy usage will still be 60% of the max bill you can expect. Okay? Because you're still air conditioning, have to keep cooling the machine down and so on. Okay? So as a result, so the ideal solution to this problem is you actually change the hardware design to make your system more energy proportional. But the problem is most systems don't behave like that. Okay, yes, question.
Could you also have a system that moves incredibly fast, like some moving distribution, some solid state moving like milliseconds?
Yeah.
So you could like do that to like dynamically start and stop servers completely?
Yes, so I think I'll talk about starting and stopping servers here. So that's one of the solutions. Okay. So given that your machines are not real servers or no machines are energy proportional, the question is how will you actually manage energy in your system? Okay. So there are many approaches that are being looked at. Okay. So they are within a server, across servers and so on. Okay. So within a server, you use OS level power management techniques. Okay. Most machines, if you have a laptop, you know that your laptop comes with some power management features built in. Okay. You will go and look at, so you can turn those on. Okay, this OS will manage your machine better. So what it will do is if you have multi-core systems, for instance, if you underload it, then some cores will be dynamically turned off, okay, by the OS. Okay, if you have no disk I/O, the disk will be temporarily spun down. Okay, and then when you start doing I/O, it will spin up again. So while there's no I/O, it won't spin. Okay, so things like that will be done, okay, by the OS for you. Okay, this will reduce the power usage of your machine, okay, because some at lower loads, some power savings can be gotten by turning components down and whatnot. Okay. There's also this thing called dynamic voltage and frequency scaling. Okay, most modern processors actually, the gigahertz rating that you say is the max gigahertz rating. You can actually run the CPU at slower speeds. Okay. And that important observation is that the frequency of the CPU is proportional to the square of the voltage. Okay? As the frequency of the CPU scales up, as you make the CPU go faster, it consumes, the power it consumes is goes up square of the voltage. Okay? In other words, power goes up quadratically as compared to the frequency. Okay? So by actually running the CPU slower speed, can significantly cut down the power that your CPU consumes. Okay? CPU is one of the big contributors of the power consumption of any machine. So the OS will actually change the frequency dynamically. Okay, CPU will run slower at lower loads and faster at higher loads. So you can do all of that and it will give you some energy savings, which is why you have this curve at all. Okay, at lower loads it actually consumes less power because the OS is also doing something to reduce the power consumption. Okay, the more effective approach is actually to just shut the server down if it is not being used. Other than to keep it idle, okay, you just completely turn it off. In that case, the power consumption is obviously going to go down to zero. Okay? But the problem with this is to make sure that there are servers you can turn off. Okay, if the server is even being used at 1% utilization, You cannot just turn it off. Okay? You have to first move that workload to some other machine and then you make it the utilization zero, at which point you can turn it off. Okay? So this requires intelligent strategies to do what is called workload consolidation. Okay? So you go around looking for underutilized servers. Okay? If you have, let's say, a web application with 100 replicas running, each replica runs on its own machine, the utilization has actually gone down of this application as a whole. All of these replicas will be running at lower levels of utilization. Okay? So you have to go and figure this out. And then you say, okay, I can make do with half the number of replicas because it's like a low peak time. It's not peak workload, but the workload has gone down. Okay? So then you go and turn off some of the replicas and shut some of those machines. Okay? This requires dynamic workload management. Okay? You could also, if you are have a virtualized data center, what you could also go and look for virtual machines that are underloaded and then just move them and pack them into a smaller number of servers. Instead of having these virtual machines spread across a much larger number of machines, if they are not loaded, then you can actually, since you can run more than one VM on a server, can pack more VMs onto a smaller number of servers and free up the other ones and turn them off. Okay? So if you actually use the highest end version of VMware, it has built-in features to do things like this. And there are other things, software products that also do the same thing. It's called consolidating the virtual machines on to a smaller number of servers. So if you do this, then you can actually realize a lot of gains. Okay, so you can dynamically vary the energy usage of your data center and make it more proportional to the workload. Okay, by actually turning machines off, you get more energy proportionality for the data center as a whole. Okay? Although you may not have energy proportional servers, your data center as a whole will have a profile where the load on the data center and the energy usage will actually be more linear, okay, rather than looking like that. Okay? So that's one set of techniques that people have used. Yeah, the other set of techniques are what are called thermal management in data centers. This relies on more intelligent air conditioning and cooling systems and more intelligent workload management. So there are two sets of things that you can do. Is move the workload to cooler servers or move the cooling to where the servers are hot. Okay, so if you have a typical data center, so let's say it's a large room and you have racks. Okay, this is one rack. And then typically you will uniformly cool all of these racks. Okay, this is the top view, so each of this is a rack. So let's assume that the applications that are running on these racks here start becoming overloaded and they start using up all of their servers. Okay? So these servers will start generating more heat. Okay. Applications running here may not be overloaded. Okay, then what you actually see is within this room, you will see that this part of the room is actually becoming warmer than that part. Okay, this part remains cool and that part remains warm. Okay. So if you have an intelligent air conditioning system, if you have sensors in the room that tell you where the heat is being generated, you can actually direct more air and more cooling to warmer parts of the room. And then this doesn't need to be, you don't have to do anything because here it's already cool. So you try to cool these machines now. Okay, here you're sending more cooling to where the workload hotspots are. Okay. Another way to handle this problem is if these machines, so if this part of the room is cooler and this part of the room is warmer, okay, then what you can do is move some of the applications from here to here. Okay, you can use virtual machine migration and move half the, let's say each rack has 40 servers. Okay, you can move 20 virtual machines from 20 of these servers to this part of the room. Okay, this will balance the room as far as the heat generation is concerned. Okay, and make the room temperature more uniform rather than having some hot spots where some racks are actually generating more heat and other racks are generating less heat. Okay, this basically says move the cooling to where the workload is. Or you can move the workload to where the cooling is. So here you are doing the opposite. Okay, so either you send more cooling to where the warmer regions of your data center, or you move the applications to cooler parts, so then you basically don't have to send more air conditioning here and more waste more energy. Okay, you just say, this is already cool, let's just migrate those workloads there. So there are techniques that are being used to do these kinds of things and also cut down the cooling costs of your data center. Okay, this was cutting down the usage cost, the electricity cost of the server. These set of techniques reduce the cooling cost, okay, the air conditioning cost for your data centers. Any questions on this? Okay, so one last thing on data centers before I start talking about clouds is this new architecture for building this data center, which are called container based. Okay. So here, rather than having a large building with these racks, what you have are these shipping containers, these 40 feet shipping containers. Here's a picture. So the same kind of container you see on a truck. Okay. So you can actually build data centers using this container. So rather than buying individual servers, many large data center operators just buy this the shipping container that comes with 2,000 or 5,000 servers. Okay, so your order of buying servers is not individual servers, but it's a container with some thousands of servers. Okay. So this container comes pre-configured. It doesn't come with boxes that you have to unpack. It comes pre-configured with racks inside the data. That's a view of what is in these containers. Okay. So it is already, there are already racks and the servers are already populated. And all this has is it has an electric plug, it has a network port, and it has an air conditioning vent. Okay. So you just connect electricity, you just connect it to your network and you connect it to your vent, and all these machines are ready to run. Okay, because the vendor has already installed the racks, installed the machine, and packed them into a one of these containers, and you just get this container and you just do it. Okay. So this is an example. This picture here shows what Microsoft has envisioned his next generation of data center to look like. So you will see that there is no building. Okay. Each of these boxes are these 40 feet containers, and they are connected to a chilling facility and UPS supplies and whatnot. Okay. This makes it much cheaper for you to build this data center. You don't have to even have a building. You just order this thing, and this thing shows up on a truck, and you just bring it in and you plug it. And then it's ready to go. Okay. The other interesting thing is that the cost of cooling this is very different from cost of cooling a large room, because the volume of what you're cooling is also much smaller. Okay. It's 40 feet by 10 feet units, not this very large humongous warehouses that are being cooled. Okay, so the cost of cooling can be reduced. Cost of deployment can also be reduced. Okay. Typical time frames for building data centers after you build the infrastructure is order of 6 months. Okay, because if you have order 50,000 servers, they will come in 50,000 boxes. Okay, you have to unpack 50,000 boxes, then you have to put them on hundreds of racks. You have to do all of the cabling. All of that is manual effort. Okay. Here it already comes pre-configured. There's nothing to unbox. I mean, it comes and you pack it. I mean, you just deploy it and you go. Okay? So it's much faster to construct. Okay? And it's much easier to use. Okay? So this is basically what data centers of the future likely to look like. Google and Microsoft have already started deploying some of these data centers. Okay? Now, so a lot of the operational and capital costs that I was talking about will be reduced if you have these kinds of architecture. Okay. And the architecture is designed so that if individual machines fail, you don't really go inside this, or you can actually enter this shipping container, but you don't do that. Okay. If entire racks fail, then you just go and replace the rack, because it's more expensive to actually take a server out, repair it and put it back. You just basically let it go. It's like $1,000 for a server. Probably costs more in human cost to repair this server than to just let it fail and just leave it fail. Okay, so the way of using these machines are also very different. Okay. Okay. So that's basically data center. So now I'll talk for a little bit on cloud computing. So what is this cloud computing thing? Okay, so essentially what a cloud computing platform is, it's a data center that looks more or less like what we have been talking about in this lecture, except for one important difference, and that difference is that these resources, these servers and the storage resources, are rented out to whoever wants to use them. Okay, in a typical data center, you are building this data center to run some applications of your own. It's your own IT infrastructure and it's your own application. So if you are Google, you build a data center and you run your applications on top of this. Right? In a cloud model, you build the infrastructure and you rent it out. So whoever wants to use it basically signs a contract with you. And the contract says, I will provide you these many resources and this is what you will pay for those resources. Okay, so you can rent resources rather than owning them. That's the big difference between a cloud computing platform and your traditional data center IT infrastructure platform. So there you own, here you rent. Okay. So essentially a cloud model is a virtualized data center, okay, and it has this self-service web portal. A self-service web portal just basically says you sign up for an account, just give you a credit card for billing and you say I want 3 machines. And then this system will automatically find 3 idle servers and tell you, here are your 3 machines, go and use them. Okay? So typically you don't even need IT administrators to say, here is a customer, which 3 machines to give them. The system is automated so that it tracks which machines are allocated, which ones are idle. And new customer comes in, asks for machines, you just say, here are 3, let's allocate them. Okay? So what does a lot of allocation of resources is completely automated, and I'll talk about how you can actually do provisioning using this model in the next slide. Okay, so it uses virtualized architecture. There are many examples of cloud platforms. Okay, Amazon's Elastic Computing Cloud is the more very popular platform. Microsoft has this Azure platform, and then there are other things like new servers cloud platforms, and so on. So there are different models that are used in the context of cloud computing. In all of these cases, you are going to rent server capacity. Okay? But the what you rent and how you rent it actually results in different models. So one important difference is what are called private cloud platforms and public cloud platforms. Okay? A public cloud platform is one where anyone can go and rent servers. Okay, and all of these customers are multiplexed onto this common set of servers. So lots of different customers that are sharing this data center. Okay, a private cloud platform is one where this entire cloud has been built for one large organization. Okay, so let's say some organization wants a cloud platform, but they want 10,000 servers. Yeah, rather than go, you don't go to Amazon and with a credit card say, give me 10,000 servers. That doesn't work. So you actually go to some other provider and they build this cloud for you. And they may run it for you. So you may go to IBM and say, I am this large financial company or I am this large bank, I need a cloud platform with 10,000 servers. So they will actually build a 10,000 cloud server cloud for you and they'll run it for you. And you will pay them. So they are renting out their capacity to you, but all of the entire infrastructure is dedicated, which is why it's private. Nobody else can see it, nobody can access it, so I'll dedicate it for you. Private, public clouds are shared infrastructure. Private clouds are dedicated infrastructure. Okay? So that's one important model, okay? Or difference in the model. The second important difference is what are you actually renting? Okay? Depends. So depending on that, you have this 3 types of cloud: infrastructure clouds, platform clouds, and software cloud. Okay? The infrastructure cloud, which is also called infrastructure as a service, rents you bare bones servers. Okay? Amazon's EC2 model effectively is what is called an infrastructure cloud. You get a bare bone machine. Okay? You can install whatever OS you want on it. You can install whatever application. They are actually renting you machines. Okay? You are free and you get root access to these machines and you can do whatever you want, run whatever OS, whatever app you want on top of it. Okay, so you get bare bone infrastructure, so they give you machine and network connectivity. That's what you are renting. Okay, you run the OS, you install everything and you do everything on your own. Okay, platform as a service essentially rents out not a machine but a software stack. It is actually renting you an OS with some application on top of it. Okay, Google App Engine is an example of a platform as a service. Okay. Here you get a web server with a Python web API. You are renting web servers with Python web API. So it's pre-configured systems with OS, web server, everything and Python API. And you can run whatever app you write on top of that. Okay. But you don't get to change the OS, you don't get to change the web server, you don't get to change the Python libraries. Everything is installed for you. So here you are essentially renting hardware plus some software. Here you are just renting hardware. Okay. And the last model is software as a service, where there is a pre-configured application. All you are doing is getting access to that application. Okay. Examples are Gmail, Google Apps. Okay. You don't even change the app. All you are doing is you get an account on those machines to run or not run, but use the app. Okay. So all of these are examples of cloud model, but depending on what you are renting and what you get, you have these different models. Okay, so starting from bare bone hardware to hardware plus software to entire application, and then the last case you don't change anything. Okay, you just get an account. Any questions on this? Okay. So let me come back to this pricing and usage model. So regardless of what model you use, there is some, since you are renting resources, you have to have some pricing model. It tells you how what these resources cost, and then there is a usage model. Okay? In most cases, cloud platforms, at least public cloud platforms, give you fine-grained pricing model. Okay? You can rent by the hour in most cases. Or you can rent storage, which is you are renting not machines but storage or disk. You can rent by I/O operation. Depending on how much I/O you do, you pay a certain amount. Okay. Depending on how many hours of a machine you use, you pay a certain amount. So it is very fine grained. Okay. And it is. And the other thing is it's a pay as you go model. Okay. You basically get a bill at the end of the month saying, oh, the last month you use these many machine hours. So this is the cost you pay for it. Okay. So just to give an example, you can look at Amazon as a simple case study. So here is Amazon's, this is their EC2 service. Here is pricing. Okay, so if you get your US pricing. So if you get a small server, so they get you different types of servers. You can get a small server, can rent a large server, can rent an extra large server. Okay, the number of cores, CPUs you get, the RAM you get, and the speed will increase as you go down. Okay, so if you take a small server and you get a Linux machine, you get 8.5 cents an hour. Okay, you can rent by the hour. So if you only use 1 hour in a month, you will only pay 8.5 cents. Okay, so you can turn on machines on and off as you want. Okay, and they'll just see for what time your machine was up, and they'll charge you accordingly. Okay, an hourly rate. Okay. Windows machines 12 cents an hour. Okay. I'm sorry? Oh, I think they have to pay for licensing costs. So Linux, they don't pay any licensing costs. So extra large here, this is almost an 8 or 16 core machine, that's like a 68 cents an hour. Okay, and so on. And then you get high memory instances that are more expensive. Okay. So it is a very fine-grained model. The important thing is you can actually rent machines by the hour. You can rent as many machines as you want. Okay. Provisioning is on the order of minutes. So if you decide you are running your web application on a cloud, okay, and we talked about provisioning, your workload has gone up. You want more instances, you just go into the login, into the web interface, say I want 10 more servers. In few minutes, you'll have 10 additional instances, and you'll just, and if you keep them up for 3 hours and your workload goes down after those 3 hours, you turn those off. So you only paid for those 3 hours of usage for these extra servers. Okay. So the big advantage of renting resources and the ability to actually rent them on the fly is that you don't have to provision for peak capacity ahead of time. You can rent on the fly, as and when you need, as your demand goes up, you rent more servers. If demand goes down, you give up those servers and they stop billing you for it. Okay. If you have to buy all of these servers, you have to pay an upfront cost to buy all of these servers. Okay. You can't buy servers on the fly. I mean, it's not going to come for a few weeks once you buy. Okay. But renting you can actually do in a near instantaneous fashion. This is one big advantage of this cloud platform. Okay, so here is, that's the pricing for, and you can see they have a whole range of operating systems, they support and applications and whatnot. So there is also a similar pricing model for their storage. So their S3 service, which is simple storage, is where they rent out server disk capacity. And this actually also has a pricing model, like 15 cents per gigabyte. Okay, that's storage. So what you pay is you pay for base storage and you pay for IOs you do on the storage. Okay. So this is 15 cents per gigabyte, and then this is data transfers. For data transfers in and out, you pay an additional cost. Okay, so if you just upload something and don't use it, okay, there's a base rental cost for just using some storage space in their system. And as you do IOs on it, they will bill you accordingly, because this is 1 cent per 1,000 requests. Okay, so they'll meter your IO requests, and you'll pay 1 cent for every 1,000 requests you make to your storage. Okay, so there are these kinds of models. So this is first 50 terabytes, and as you rent more and more, it becomes cheaper. Yeah, you get some volume pricing and so on. So similar things are true for other clouds. So this here is another one. Servers. Okay, so here is a different provider, smaller one than Amazon. So they charge you 11 cents an hour for medium. Here they actually shown you the configuration. You get a Intel Xeon 2.8 GHz single core. Okay, medium, you get a dual core machine, you pay 17 cents an hour, 2 GB RAM. You have large, which is quad core. Your jumbo is, I think, 8 core. And there is fast. Fast is also quad core, but those are faster CPUs. So you'll see the pricing is also on a per hour basis and so on. Okay, same philosophy as any other cloud platform, just happens to be a different provider. Okay, so important thing to keep in, that this gives you, because you pay as you go and you can bring up servers or shut them down on the fly, can vary the capacity. You can actually do dynamic provisioning very easily with cloud models, and there is no need to pre-build your IT infrastructure for peak needs. Okay, you can get machines as your needs changed. Okay. So I talked about Amazon's virtual servers and storage. There are many other services they provide. Okay. That is infrastructure as a service. Okay. These things are more software as a service. So here you can get their Amazon database service. So you can actually get pre-configured database servers that they have built for you. Okay, so you are now not renting bare-bone machines, you are renting OS and a piece of software. Okay, this is your software as a service model. Okay, so they have a simple DB service, and they have their relational database service. They also build what are called virtual private clouds. Okay, if you are a small or medium-sized organization that don't need like 10, 20 server, but hundreds of servers, they will actually make a small private cloud for you. Okay, although it is hosted on their public infrastructure, it looks like it is dedicated for you. Okay? A pure private cloud is actually dedicated. Somebody has built this for you, custom built it for you, and only you can access it. Okay? Amazon tries to emulate that model by setting aside some machines and IP address pools for you and whatnot. But it's still multiplex. So it looks like a virtual private cloud, not a real private, but it is actually a virtual private cloud. So they have that service as well. So there are this host of services that many of these cloud providers are providing. And then there's Google with App Engine, and Azure with their own, Microsoft with their own cloud model and so on. So pretty much every large company, IT company, is trying to have some sort of a cloud platform that they are using or providing to someone else. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind. So that's where we will stop today. Okay, so that's basically the end of not only this class but also the course. There's only one more thing in addition to the final exams, which is course evaluations. You need a volunteer to hand this out, and then somebody needs to then go to the main office. Anybody want to do this? Okay, so there on the back side of this, you can give comments and feedback. So would appreciate any comments about the course, how to make it better, or what you liked or didn't like. Okay, that will be helpful for future versions. So just 1 second. So let me. I shouldn't, technically I shouldn't be in the room while you're doing this. So I'll just.